Hello, witches. This is Kara Kovacs, and this is Business Witch. As a third generation witch, at least, and a business and life coach for mission-driven entrepreneurs and leaders, I teach you how to make money and magic as liberatory practices. Because when we know, seek, and embrace our full potential, we create a better world for everyone. Here you'll find tools, conversations, spells, and inspiration that take you from waiting to creating so you can build the business and life you're oh so worthy and capable of having. Let's go. Hello, witches. We have a very special guest for you today. It's one of my very best friends, and I asked her to do this episode because she has a really important story to tell. I think it's a really important story to hear right now. And there are so many nuances that we'll get into in a second when you hear from her directly. But from, you know, trusting the process to important things that you should be knowing about activism in our world right now, it is my pleasure to introduce you to Sarah Denari.
Thank you so much for having me. Hello, everyone.
Sarah and I have known each other since 2017.
It's always dreams always that. Feels like forever.
And we met at a camp that Sarah co-founded. Do you want to tell people a little bit about what Ground Shift was?
Yeah, it was a adult summer camp for activists. It was kind of an answer to the 2016 presidential elections, where a lot of us felt a little bit out of power and out of control. And it was a way for us to bring like intersectionality to, we were both living in New York at the time, New York City, and it was a way to bring New York City activists together under one roof to, you know, connect, educate each other, learn from one another, and basically create activism outside of the camp once it was done.
And I went there as a participant and was lucky enough to get to spend some quality time with Sarah. And we have been close friends ever since. And Sarah has always inspired me with not only her commitment to activism, but the vastness of her knowledge and her ability to communicate things that are really complicated and sometimes difficult to talk about with a lot of love and acceptance that isn't alienating. It really invites you in. And I think that that's an example that we all need right now in our own lives around having conversations with people in our families, maybe, or our partners' families or our community where we're just like not seeing eye to eye. But I also have witnessed your journey professionally. And I think as somebody who coaches entrepreneurs, there's a lot that people could learn from hearing a little bit about your story. Where would you like to start?
Oh my gosh. I guess we can start post-college and like basically when I moved to New York and how that arc happened, because it really was a, how do you get to somewhere that you don't even know you want to be in? So I graduated from college in 2014, and I went to New York immediately after graduating from California. And it very much was a, I have to go to New York, I'm working for the UN. My entire life, I should say this, like preface this, has been shaped by the fact that I'm an immigrant to this country. My family came here when I was 5 years old, and it really became the central like element of my life is experiencing the U.S., experiencing growing up here through the lens of immigrant parents and being an immigrant myself and straddling two cultures. So going to school and going to college was very much like, I have to study diplomacy. I'm an Iranian. I've been an Iranian activist since 2009, around the time of the Green Revolution that was happening in Iran. And it's very similar to the revolution that started in Iran last year after the death of Mahsa Jina Amini at the hands of the morality police. So very much similar instance. A young woman was killed in 2009. She became the face of a lot of, you know, activism and dissidents basically raging against the Islamic Republic's regime and their authoritative way of dealing with citizenry in Iran, amongst all other, you know, horrendous things that they've done that we can talk about. But right around that time was a very pivotal moment for me. I was in high school and I was trying to decide what my career would be. And I ended up going into a educational career around politics and diplomacy. My goal in moving to New York was to become a diplomat for the UN. So I moved myself and my partner at the time across the country for this goal. And in my first week moving to New York, I spent, you know, the obligatory 9 to 10 days applying to the UN, filling out this insane application. And upon applying, I got an immediate response from my submittal that said, you are a national of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it was around the time of the Obama nuclear talks. So they weren't accepting any applications from the Islamic Republic's citizenry. And I was immediately blocked from this career path that I thought was the only path for me going into the city and starting my career. So very much at that time, like, you're deflated in a way that you can't even imagine, because this is what you've imagined your whole life being. And then it was, okay, I moved across the country. What now? How do I parlay this, you know, terrible situation and timing into, like, rent and, like, eating food? Paying bills for the first time in my life. And so I raged against the machine in a way and went into tech. I was like, you know, if I'm not going to be able to make no money saving the world, I'm going to make a ton of money destroying the world.
Oh my God.
I know it sounds bad now, but not that tech is in any way a destruction of the world, but it very much felt like if I can't do the thing that I've always thought I can do, then I might as well sell out, make a ton of money. And I think this also, like, very much reflects the relationship I had with money. It always felt very evil. It always felt like people who have a ton of money are evil. And I think just, like, raised in a low-income household, like, money is just such a stressor that I thought, if I made a lot of money, it would mean that I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. If I made a lot of money, it would mean that I'm immoral in some ways. And because the world, the universe wouldn't allow me to be, you know, following this career path that felt very noble and very much in the realm of wanting to save the people of my country, save the women of my country, my home country, then I was going to do everything in my power to be the antithesis of that, you know?
Mm-hmm. It was like a table flipping moment. Yes. Of like, well, fuck you then, I'll just...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I started working in tech, and I was lucky enough to find a tech company that had that balance of activism and work. I was working for a company at the time called ThoughtWorks, and they were heavily involved in the activist space of New York City. So I was managing the New York office at the time, and I worked, you know, hand in hand with a lot of activists that used our space in the evenings for their meetings, for their events. Our founder, the founder of that company, really believed in, like, grassroots movement. And so he utilized a lot of his resources, and a lot of our offices around the world, particularly New York and San Francisco, provided their space to local groups like Women Who Code and Girls Who Code and those kinds of things, in addition to other activism that was cropping up around that 2016-2017 presidential election. So I was introduced to a lot of really cool activists in New York, and when the election happened, we thought, oh man, like, how are we going to do this? Like, how are we going to continue to conduct ourselves normally in a world that feels very much different from the perception that we've had of it? And then that arc took me into, you know, working hand in hand with other activists in New York for several years and burning myself out fully. Like, you work 9 to 5, and then from 5 to 10, you're an activist and you're creating petitions and you're going to protests on the weekends. And it just felt like there was never a stop to the work. The work was always, there was always more work to be done. And obviously that's not sustainable. And very quickly I found myself burnt out and resentful, and even resentful of the movements I was a part of because they were moving too slow. And why does no one care? And that feeling of screaming into a void that you feel a lot as an activist. All activists can relate to, you know, whatever cause is near to their heart, and the fact that not enough people care, and how can you not care about the children? And that feeling of, you know, your bleeding heart and recognizing that you're alone in that. It's a really hard thing to reckon with. So after a few years of going in and out of nonprofit organizations and different tech companies, I found myself like incapable of touching the tips of my fingers to the keyboard of my computer. Like I literally didn't want to do anything. And you can't do that in a capitalist society. It shows up very quickly, especially when you're an overachiever otherwise. And one thing led to another, and I decided to just quit my job and like sleep.
I remember leading up to the decision, like you went back and forth for a few months and then you were done.
Yeah. I, the morning that I quit, I didn't even know that I was going to quit that day. Like I woke up, I was having a meeting with my boss. It was like beginning of the week. We had this meeting every week and she was like, "What's going on with you? Like, you're not yourself." And I was like, "I quit." It was just like the words exited my mouth and then I realized what I had said. Mm-hmm. It was like my body took over and was like, you can't clearly make this decision. I'm making it for you. And as an immigrant kid, that is such a like departure from what you're taught. Never leave a job until you have another one lined up. Never put yourself in a like a scarcity mindset, like in a place where you know that you can't make money. Be secure. That financial security has always been, and we've talked about this before, such a trigger for me, such a like main element of my career up until this point was like, if I can't be a diplomat, then at least I'll be secure financially. And then I was neither. And yeah, that was a hard thing to step into.
Mm-hmm. I think watching you do it too, because like we hang out several times a week.
Karen knows the story.
But like, I think there was, you know, you were like, am I going to transition into starting my own business? Am I going to do this? Am I going to do that? And now, you know, that you have a different job, looking back on that time, I remember thinking like, maybe you're just supposed to be sitting.
Mm.
But I find it intolerable to not work when I'm not filling it with a vacation or filling it with a family obligation, like to actually just sit.
Yes.
I think is incredibly difficult for so many reasons, but many of them cultural. And I'm just curious, like reflecting on, it was a year.
It was a year, just over a year and a couple of months. Yeah.
Like, what do you wish that you could have told that self?
Oh my gosh. So the first couple of months, it was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do about my bills? Like, it was very much such a like mental hurdle to get over. But the like catalyst for me being like, just let go. You can always make money. Like you can, you know, get gigs, whatever it might be to survive. And I'm lucky enough. I have a partner who was able to support me and savings that were able to support me from my evil corp job. You know, like I had a safety net. So all of it was in my mind. Like it was all in my head. And I wish I could tell myself like, you know what, just rest. Like, yes, while you're resting, your mind is like asking a million questions a minute. But a turning point conversation was actually with you and our friend Uli.
Mm.
We were sitting on my couch and Uli had a very similar experience after finishing her book where she had like nothing going on for a minute. And she said, you know what, Sarah, I sat on my couch for 3 months and it was glorious. And I look back on those 3 months of just like watching TV and crying and watching TV and like eating and like having those moments of reflection. We are so accustomed to in this like insane capitalist system that we're in to be filling our time and our space with something. Even if it's a vacation, it's like work. Mm-hmm. You're doing something. An activity has to be happening at all times for you to feel like you're wise with your time or mm-hmm. utilizing that time in a way that's like valuable. And Uli saying to me, like, I took 3 months and did absolutely nothing. When I see Uli as the accomplished, incredible person that she is, it almost gave me permission to be like, even the most incredible person that I look up to has said, spending time doing nothing is not time spent poorly. I need to really take that in. So after that conversation, I almost took it too far. I was like, fuck it. I'm on permanent vacation until I say I'm not. And then it becomes a balance. Like, do you really do nothing for so long? And how do you get back into it? How do you get back into that gear? So I spent the year reflecting. I spent the year crying. I spent the year forgiving myself for putting my body through what I had put my body through. And I spent the year being an activist with all of that free time and headspace that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And also educating myself on empathy, educating myself on understand, like, you and I had a conversation about Mahsa Amini and the revolution in Iran, and you were like, oh, I can't believe I didn't know that, and I can't believe I didn't know this. And as we were talking through it, like, how is this not on the news? How are people not thinking? And in that conversation, I realized, like, I have so much love and empathy for Kara. She's clearly one of my best friends. She knows me inside and out, and she knows my culture. She knows about Iran more than most people, especially more than most white people. And even she didn't know these things. I need to recognize that I need to come into this space and into these conversations with empathy and understanding that I don't know about all of the intricacies of what's going on in Mongolia. I don't, you know, like, everything is so personal when it's activism that is so close to home that it's hard not to be. And I'm sure that I've had conversations with my Jewish friends and my Palestinian friends right now who are like, you don't get it. And of course I don't. And all we can do is enter those conversations open and willing and with our, like, most tender parts of ourselves available to be able to fully be there for our friends and just let them know that, like, I hear you and I'm trying. And having those conversations with you were an educational moment for me in how I approach my activism and how I approach people and why you should care about this. Why the Islamic Republic's, like, funding of, you know, terror in the Middle East is an issue for everyone in the world, not just for Iranians, even though it is particularly important for Iranians. So there's, yeah, many ways to come at activism and burnout that are similar. It's like, come at yourself with empathy, come at yourself with compassion, come at yourself with the understanding that there needs to be an education that happens in order for you to come at this really important and really hard work in a way that is sustainable, in a way that is going to bring about change.
I think there were so many great nuggets in what you said, but one of the things that I feel like I want to name, that, correct me if I'm wrong, because you are so much better at speaking to your experience than I am, but also my impression of that time was you had quit like maybe 2 or 3 months before Mahsa Amini's death and before the protests kicked off, and there was a simultaneous reconciliation of your cultural identity. At, like, you had talked a lot at that time about feelings of survivor's guilt and, like, what it meant to be here and to have been born there. And when you say you spent that time being an activist, what I felt like was missing from what you said from the story was you were, like, reposting, resharing, like, cataloging, like, basically creating. And this is the one thing I really am loving about social media right now, like, more verifiable, like, civilian-based or people-based, humanist, like, laser-focused on the specifics of what is going on, resources. Like, if I wanted to know about what was going on in Iran, like, the best place to go was your story. You also spent the year doing that.
Yeah. I mean, it almost felt like the stars aligned and allowed me to put all of my attention into this. And you know me, like, I actually hate social media. Like, not hate as in I hate it because of what it is, but I hate participating. Like, I don't like writing stories. I don't like posting about my life. Like, I'm a very private person in general. But it felt like a betrayal not to do everything I can to hashtag be their voice. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it was such an important thing. And you're right, like, the survivor's guilt, now I'm removed a year from it and it's different now. Now it's like, oh, I'm here for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I remember having conversations with my brother where he was like, I would rather be in Iran and get arrested and put in jail than being safe in this home. Like, there was such a feeling of, like, we're not there, what are we doing? Like, why are we even around if we're not there to fight this really important fight? And all I could do to, like, maintain my sanity was to mentally and emotionally be there as much as I could, because I couldn't be on the ground marching against, you know, bullets flying past 14, 15, 16-year-olds who are the main, like, demographic of this revolution. So yeah, cataloging, documenting, putting stories. And I had people reach out to me from, like, all walks of my life, from college when I was, you know, heavily involved in politics and working for the United Nations Associations of California, all the way through to, like, my boss, my last boss in tech, like right before I left tech, messaging me, like, if it wasn't for your stories, I would have no idea this was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that kept me going. That got me, like, waking up every morning, going through all of the different citizen journalists of Iran that I knew about, reading the stories of what happened the night before, and then you see a whole host of hashtags of new names that have been arrested or killed, and now is the time for you to disseminate that message.
Yeah.
So that time difference, it was like everything was going on while I was asleep, and then it was my job to wake up, figure out what happened while I was asleep, and then disseminate that information as quickly and as, like, concisely as possible to an audience of Americans that otherwise wouldn't have access to this information.
So there are two directions I want to go with this. I think we need to cover both. One being how that actually ended up sort of creating your next job.
Mm-hmm.
And also what I want to name for, like, during that time, you redesigned my website. You redesigned my mom's website.
Yes.
And so the reason I just want to name that is because, like, this is a podcast for entrepreneurs. And I'm always telling people, like, get a side hustle. Like, you have some kind of marketable skill. You could be delivering for DoorDash. Like, never consider yourself in such a state of, like, financial incapacity that, like, you're just going to completely run out of money. And I think that that fear keeps people from leaving jobs that they hate or thinking that they can create a business. They're like, well, what am I going to do? And it's like, you may be less cash flush than you have been. I certainly was in the year and a half that I started my business.
Right.
And, like, there are ways to make money. It is a lie of capitalism that you need to stay at your job that you hate, burnt out, and, like, depressed in your life versus, yes, like, doing something else. So I just, like, I wanted to say that as an aside, and also, you know, acknowledging that you had a spouse and, like, and savings and the privilege to have those things. And that, right, when I left my job, I got 6 months of family leave, and I also had a profitable side hustle. So, like, I acknowledge the privilege in that. And, like, when my mom went back to college in her 50s, she delivered pizza. Like, yes, anybody can do, yes, it.
Exactly. Totally. I mean, I think there was definitely panic in moments where I knew the bills were coming down the pipeline and you had to figure it out. But I'm lucky enough to be able to teach myself things, and we all have the internet accessible to us to allow us to up-level our skills. And yes, redesigning websites. I helped a couple of friends redesign their spaces, physical spaces. And so those gigs paid the bills and gave me, like, space, mm-hmm, more than anything else, like mental space to not worry about those kinds of things and focus on what to me was the most important cause of my life, which was the revolution in Iran and making sure that I was doing everything in my power to bring that information to the foreground.
Mm-hmm. Which led to.
Which led to. So I was following, you know, as many organizations and nonprofit organizations in particular that were working on Iran's liberation. And one of them that I found to be incredibly prolific was the Iranian Diaspora Collective. So, you know, hitting their stories every day, every morning, you know, my punch list. And a couple of months ago, I saw that they had posted something to the effect of, like, hi, we're hiring, like, someone for our editorial team. If you're interested, like, email us at this email. And I had written a couple of articles around Iran, and I did a lot of research, political research, when I was in college for work. And I reached out to them. I sent them my article as a writing sample. It happened to be the exact topic they were interested in, and a little bit of my research acumen from previous work that I had done. And it ended up being such a brilliant marriage. Like, I had no idea that I could be paid for the work that I'd been doing for the last year. I didn't even dream of it. I just thought activism is this, you know, like, bloody your knuckles and, you know, walk barefoot and, like, struggle, because that's what activism is portrayed as. But now I'm doing very similar work to what I was doing before, doing a little bit more writing, a little bit more research, of course, but still staying up on what's going on in Iran, staying up on this revolution and supporting the women of this revolution. And, you know, woman, life, freedom to me is incredibly intersectional. It's Kurdish, it's Jewish, it's Baha'i. It's so many things are encompassed under woman, life, freedom, which is the mantra of this revolution. There is no equity until women are completely equitable in society. There is no life without equity for everyone. And there's no freedom unless everyone is free. You know, we hear it all the time, and it's such a trope that's easy to repeat. None of us are free until all of us are free. But it's so real. And we're seeing that play out within the geopolitically over the last 2 months.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about what you think is important for people to know from the perspective of an activist, from the perspective of maybe a friend or a daughter. You know, I know right now has been such a hard time for my clients. It's been a hard time for me. It's a hard time for the world, with people just losing relationships over differences of opinions and the inability to even have a conversation with someone who is not in 100% agreement with how you already feel, which is really dangerous when we're looking at the cost of the lack of those conversations coming down to human life.
Yes.
And potentially, you know, international war. And I'm just curious for you to share, like, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a level of empathy that comes with seeing fellow activists, in particular, for me, Palestinian activists, which my algorithm is giving me more of. There's an empathy that comes with having to see them fight to prove their humanity. I think being a person of color, recognizing the relationship that, you know, white privilege has in all elements of oppression. There is a thorough line between all of, you know, Black Lives Matter and the fight for Palestinian liberation, the fight in Iran. Seeing children having to stand in front of news cameras to ask the world to see their humanity, I think it's incredibly challenging to continue on with the conversations with people who disagree with you when you're seeing such stark examples of how hard it is to fight this fight. And then having people in your life come to you and say, like, but this, and, you know, no buts. When children are being killed, when innocent civilians are being killed, it hurts. And conversations outside of that, like, I haven't had the, like, ability to have space for. And I know other activists can relate that sometimes it's just too much. And you have so much resentment and you have so much. But it is also a time for us to challenge ourselves and stop ourselves from showing love to those that deserve love. Like, I have many, many Jewish friends who are incredibly hurt, fearful, afraid to walk outside. Absolutely devastating. Absolutely devastating. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that holding multiple feelings that might feel contrary is really hard in any capacity. In tech, when I work, you know, like, there's holding multiple contrary ideas is so challenging, rips you apart, makes you feel emotions you probably never have felt. My heart rate is rising as I'm talking about it, even, you know, like, it's so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It's so tender. But here we are, you and me, a couple of best friends. I was raised in a Muslim household. You were raised in a Jewish household. And recognizing that coexisting with one another is the only way. Division and divisive language and divisive, you know, ideology is going to help this capitalist society continue to put us all in these situations, to put us all in danger, to put us all in harm's way. It's only when we recognize that our collective freedom is so much more important, is so much more tangible than we think, recognizing that our working together will dismantle these systems of oppression is the thing that keeps me motivated. It's the idea that keeps me paid. It's like, you know, like it's true as much as the systems and global arena want us to believe that we are divided and we can't see eye to eye.
Yeah. That was beautiful. I think too, like when I was watching you spend that year being like, maybe I'll do this and maybe I'll do this and maybe I'll do this. And then this job came in and it was like, if you had taken any other job, if you had gone 100% into starting a business, if you had gone back to school, like there was no better way for you to be spending the time than like healing the burnout.
Yes.
And we just don't live in a society that writes prescriptions for like taking a break.
Yes.
You know, we live in a society where I know people who take medication to stay awake on the overnight shift that like intentionally fucks up your circadian rhythm. Like that's the society that we live in. So I think too, I just reflect on like almost the divinity in, even if it's not the job you have forever, the right opportunity that could point you and put together all of the pieces. And one of the reasons I wanted to share this again is for people listening who are in such conflict with they're not liking what they're doing. They feel lost about where to go about it. They wish that they could fast forward through that process. I also felt that way right before I started my business, where I was like, well, I can't financially afford to be a social worker. I hate this job that I have. It makes me have the Sunday scaries on Saturday night, not even on Sunday. Yeah. Like I am constantly anxious. Is this like what the point is? And then putting the business together and being like, is this going to work? Is it going to be okay? Like I'm trying things. I don't know. And looking back and saying, oh, wow, like I was a copywriter in my early 20s and now I'm using those skills to write all of my emails. I had a fashion blog and now I like know how to use Instagram because of that. You know, I was a social worker and I have a women's studies degree, which is why I have an anti-racist intersectional feminist praxis to my business.
Yes.
Like all of those pieces were happening to get here, but I was in such judgment of the timing, the path, the safety, my own capability. Like, and I think that everybody has their own version of that. And we deserve a little bit more self-compassion. And sometimes you can't plan for the great things that are going to find their way to you.
Absolutely. I mean, talk about having ideas. I was starting like 7 businesses before lunch. Like there's like one thing about having that time and space and the privilege of being able to have that time and space was I was all over the place. It's like looking at the cereal aisle today. It's like way too many options. How do you hone in? And actually the afternoon that I saw that, you know, that posting in their stories was an afternoon where I was like on Instagram and beating myself up for not being on my computer and like not applying to a job. So I'm like miserable, but I'm scrolling Instagram miserably. And I saw that post and it very much was like the first time I had seen something and I was like, ooh, I should apply to that. And then immediately got to my computer and started working towards applying to that. Mm. It felt very divine. Like it felt very much like, oh my God, could I actually be paid for doing this research that I'm already doing for disseminating this? But you can. And I recognize that I fell into this in a very like lucky way. I know that there were also many other applicants who would have been in the same position. You know, like there is... Yes, and. Mm. Like, yes, I fell into this divine situation that gave me work that makes my heart sing and makes me feel challenged and I know does something for this world that I am passionate about and would be doing anyway. But it also gave me a little bit of like recognition that, oh, maybe I shouldn't have been beating myself up for all of those months. And like, you know, the negative self-talk that happens when you have time to rest, like breaking out of the, I constantly have to be doing something. And if I'm not, I'm lazy. And it's like, I physically couldn't. My eyes, my hands, my body physically couldn't. Yeah. And now you see that all of that time that you spent berating yourself could have been time where you just enjoyed yourself, gave yourself space. And my partner at the time said constantly, like, he was like, just sleep. It's okay. Like, just sleep. It's fine. And I'm like, I can't sleep. I have to do, let me clean out the oven. Let me, you know, like something has to happen.
Yeah.
Or I'm not worthy of just resting. I'm not worthy of just having nothing to do. Like, where will I gain my value from? What will I get value out of?
Well, and it's interesting because if you're doing the same work now and you're getting paid for it and you're getting value from that, like you were doing that work then, but you didn't see it as valuable.
Right. Or I didn't see it as something anyone was willing to put a value on. And even still, I'm like, I still would be doing this work if I wasn't getting paid for it. I would just have to find a way to make it work.
Yeah. Well, that's how you know you found your thing.
Yes.
Because like, that's how I feel about coaching. It's like, I would still be doing it even if I wasn't making money off of it.
Yes. Yes. It's like, this is what I have to be doing.
Yeah.
Like what, and you know, there's a lot around activism for Iran in particular, that's rather dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my face and name are now out there. I'll never be able to go back to Iran. I'll never be able to go to my motherland, walk the orchards that my ancestors planted until this government is overthrown, because I will be immediately arrested or whatever they would do to a political dissident like me. I'm a refugee to this country. So they'll be like, where have you been? Where have you been the last 30 years? You know? So there's a danger, and we're seeing it more and more. The Iranian government, the current Iranian government, finds political dissidents in other countries. The example of Jamshid Sharmad being on a business trip and being basically kidnapped and brought to Iran, and now he's been a political prisoner for several years. His daughter, he's a German citizen and American national. It doesn't matter. You're not safe as an activist against this regime. So I know that this work comes with risk. I know that this work also comes with knowing I'm never going to be able to see my grandmother's resting place until these people are removed. So it's not all sunshine and rain. It's not all great. But I can't think of, like, my mom came to me and was like, are you sure you want to be doing this? Are you sure you're going to be putting your name out there? You're writing these articles. You're writing these things. And I'm like, if I was doing anything else with my time, it would be a waste of time in my eyes. I can't think of anything more important and more valuable for me to be putting my skills and energy towards than this work. Mm-hmm. And this is for me. Everybody has that thing. And regardless of the danger, regardless of the hard work, regardless of how terrible it is to wake up to text messages every morning of all of the things that have happened overnight that you have to now, you know, we have such access to what's going on in Palestine because of the citizen journalists on the ground, allowing us to see in real time, expose us in real time to the atrocities happening. I've been watching these kinds of atrocities happening for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a toll, but that toll is beyond worth it for those citizen journalists exposing us to things we otherwise wouldn't have access to. I feel like this is the first war that we're seeing fully in the digital age. Like, yes, we've seen a lot out of Ukraine as well, but for some reason, the citizen journalism, I think Ukraine is covered by mainstream media because of the nature of where Ukraine is located in the world and what the people of Ukraine look like.
Yeah.
So seeing these citizen journalists doing the work that should have been done, but also recognizing how hard it must be for them to say, look at my humanity, look at these bodies on the ground.
Yeah.
Like honoring that work in the West is, I think, a duty that we all have, especially us activists. Honoring them by disseminating their work, honoring them by making sure that we look. And yes, there's a limit to how many dead babies I can see before I fall apart. But I owe it to those lives to make sure that I don't look away, to make sure that I share their stories. There's a phrase that we use at my work where we say, we hold the dreams of everyone who's died in our hearts. Because once they die, these are young people with, particularly in Iran and in Palestine, young people who had hopes and dreams and wanted to go to school and wanted to have, you know, and forgetting that humanity is something that happens and when people become numbers on a piece of paper.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I think, too, it might be helpful to invite people to consider their news sources with a more critical lens.
Totally.
Which, I don't know, I feel like my audience, like anybody who is subscribed to my email list or this podcast, I feel like we're like all on the same page. Otherwise, they leave.
they would be dipping.
They leave.
Especially
yeah.
After this conversation, they're out.
Well, and I've, you know, I sent some emails out that I'm like, if you do not agree with me, don't buy my products. Mm. Which is, it's interesting, I think, to be so polarizing in business. But then I consider how deeply personal business is. Like when you buy a product from somebody, you want to know how they are spending their money mm-hmm. and you want to know how they are treating their employees and you want to know if they care about the environment. And so on the one hand, it's easier to have these conversations when people agree with you, like the people listening, the people in my client basis, the people, you know, we live very much in this bubble where we have the privilege of people who are looking at the same news sources as us, who are critically thinking about what it is that they are taking in, which makes it very hard. And I've experienced this in my own life in the past couple of weeks to like try to talk about it with a family member and hear things like, oh, I had never really thought about it like that. You need to be careful about how you talk about this, which is, you know, something that was said to me. And from my perspective, it's really like if you think critically about what it is that we are receiving or reading for 2 seconds, just the difference in language. You know, we were talking about this, you and I, this morning around the ceasefire of saying that they're releasing Israeli children and Palestinian minors. Like there's a phrasing that is used in mass media that actually extracts humanity from the narrative. And so if we read that and we aren't thinking critically and we just absorb it as a story or as the truth, it makes sense why there's a lack of understanding and an inability to have a conversation between people. And those conversations are so important. And, you know, what I've said in my own family is like, if we had a terrorist inside of the Empire State Building, you wouldn't send a bunch of bombs over Midtown Manhattan and tell all the people who live there to walk to New Jersey. Like, that's literally...
Oh, my God. When it's so literal with the locales. Oh, my God.
But it's like... Because when I say, you know, they're dropping... But they're like, well, we have to get Hamas. They were under the hospital. And it's like, if your baby was in the NICU at that hospital, like... And I think so much of that has to do with white supremacy, where we're able to disconnect and we're able to say, like, I'm saying we as Americans or as American culture, there's been such rampant Islamophobia for so many decades that, as you said, dehumanize people and imagine, well, that happening over there must have just caused, despite the fact that like all these international human rights organizations are saying that this is a violation of international law. So that's what I said to people in my family. And they were like, I never thought of it that way.
And how could they have thought about it that way when they're being fed a narrative that is contrary, you know? Mm-hmm. And thinking critically about news is something that we've only become awakened to, at least I've only become awakened to, in the last decade. Like before that, it's like, I trust the news. They want to tell me what's going on in the world. And unless you have a very personal reason not to trust the news, like I stopped trusting the news when, you know, I saw that like 6 weeks went by before the New York Times said anything about the, you know, 5,000 people who were being arrested in Iran on a daily basis. You know, like we only start to distrust entities once they've shown us that they are not trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, for people who have not seen that these news agencies are not necessarily trustworthy or have bias or have a pony in the race, you know, then otherwise they wouldn't know. And I want to say that the rise in anti-Semitism is also incredibly horrific and such a reality for, you know, so many people in my life that that's also can't be ignored. You know, it's happening simultaneously, and it's important to acknowledge both. Like, mm-hmm. unless we acknowledge both, we're not able to join forces. Mm-hmm. Like, there are Jewish people in my life who are right now, like, horrified of walking down the street in their neighborhood because, you know, they've seen threats against their local
synagogue.
Like, threats against their local synagogue. So it's impossible for me to understand fully what they're going through. All I can do is show empathy and love to everyone in my life who's experiencing trauma right now, because we all are experiencing mm-hmm. trauma right now. And also speaking truth to power when those individuals say things that might not necessarily be true through the lens of, you know, some of the things I'm seeing that they might not be seeing in their feed. Our algorithms really are good at keeping us in our lane. And it's up to us to reset that. It's up to us to break out of those echo chambers and recognize what we aren't seeing on a daily basis.
And to build those bridges, because our humanity depends on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So with all of that being said, thank you so much for being here. I think I was like, let's just see what happens when we start talking. Like,
I don't think we'd ever run out of things to talk about. This might have to be a four-parter.
Yeah, we didn't plan any of the content. I knew that I wanted you to tell your story about going from the UN into corporate, into burnout, into a job that like really aligns with something that you were already, how we met.
Right.
Like literally right. how we met. I knew that, but I didn't know really where this would go. And I think, you know, as a Jew, I've been really unpacking the distinction between being a Jew and the political affiliation with the country of Israel. And I know that you talk so much about being Iranian and not necessarily the regime of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yes.
And I think that that distinction needs to be spoken about more broadly in the Jewish community, that like being Jewish, like I'm not Israeli, I'm Eastern European, but that there's a narrative where to be Jewish is to be Israeli. And I think that breeds a kind of nationalism that makes it really hard to disconnect. And then we get statements like self-hating Jews, or that we are, I don't know, like against our own people.
Right.
For saying, I don't support genocide.
Yeah.
And that's a ludicrous conversation to have and an impossible position to be in. And I haven't like said that so explicitly publicly because I've been thinking about what do you say to people who can't hear that right now because of how much they are in grief. And I think I've just kind of arrived at like you say it anyway. And I just want to thank you because I think that this conversation where you've been able to hold both of those parallels really provided some thought-provoking ideas and frameworks and ways of relating to what's happening right now for the people who are listening.
Yeah. I mean, thank you for having me. Our conversations are always thought provoking, and I always walk away from hanging out with each other with new ways of approaching subjects, especially these types of subjects that we've cried about them. And I've had a challenge in my identity being raised in a Muslim household or Muslim family and not really identifying as Muslim myself, but recognizing that I've been called Islamophobic for fighting against the Islamic Republic's regime, even though 98% of Iranians are Muslim, and I'm fighting for those Muslims in my country. So there's, holding space for both is vital in our survival and vital in our liberation.
And if people want to learn more about you, the work that you're doing, where would you send them? What should they be following?
They can follow me, my stories, Estinari on Instagram. And I think following more places like the Iranian Diaspora Collective, organizations that are doing the work, that have been doing the work, and are able to hold all of these ideas in a beautiful and compassionate way.
For those of you who are wondering, Sarah is a Sag. Sag moon.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Thank you for being here.
Thank
Love you.
Love you.